The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Today on the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADEA, Alliance Defending Freedom. Democrats hold America hostage.
Democrats are taking this opportunity to try to achieve an ideological wish list.
The Secretary of State of the United States on America holding the line around the world.
There are, in fact, many nations that had their outbreak begin with transit from China.
Meanwhile, workers on the ground prepare for more trouble.
Everyone around here is bracing for this tsunami, if you will, of cases.
Dr. Fauci addresses a media absurdity.
Reading into my not being there as a risk with the president is absolutely ridiculous. It really is. There's nothing like that going on at all.
I'm Hugh Hewitt. Great to be with you. Catch my program each weekday morning live 6 to 9 a.m. Eastern Time and on demand 24/7. Learn more at HughHewitt.com and let me invite you to join me now by video. And follow me on Twitter at Hugh Hewitt. Follow this program as well at Town Hall Review. The week began with chaos as the stock market took yet another nosedive, this time in reaction to the Democrats blocking a stimulus package that they helped create. But Speaker of the House Nancy Pelosi and her progressive friends in the House saw the stimulus not as an opportunity to help struggling Americans, but rather as a chance to slip through a massive pile of left-wing dreams and red tape onto fellow citizens' lives. From pieces of the Green New Deal to changing the way that Americans vote, Democrats in the House unpacked a host of laws they know the public does not want and tried to jam it onto the rescue package. But people desperately need that rescue package. They are waiting on it. And to take advantage of their constituents during desperate times is deeply cynical, indeed immoral. On Tuesday, Republicans began to strip away much of the nonsense that Democrats had put into the package, and markets responded with the best single day on the Dow since 1933. The next morning, I invited Senator Tom Cotton on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Senator, I've broadcast through national crises like 9/11, Katrina, 2008, and I've been on the air through political earthquakes like Justice Thomas and Kavanaugh confirmations, the elections of 00 and 16. Never have those two types of stories intersected, a national crisis, an international crisis, and Democrats holding America hostage. What is going on?
Hugh, unfortunately, this country faces a pandemic crisis unlike anything we've seen in 100 years, and we're losing lives. Millions of people are losing their jobs or seeing their retirement savings evaporate. Yet the Democrats are taking this opportunity to try to achieve an ideological wish list. As you saw yesterday, Nancy Pelosi released a 1,400-page bill, 1,400 pages cobbled together in just a day, more than three times the length of our bill, that would do things like require airlines to be carbon neutral, which I bet doesn't apply to Nancy Pelosi's private plane, or give $35 million to an opera house in Washington, D.C., while restaurants are shut all across the country, or mandate all kinds of sweeping changes to our voting rules. That's from the partisan geniuses who couldn't even count their own votes in the Iowa Democratic caucuses. This is the kind of political games that Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer are playing. It is disgraceful, and it has to stop today.
Senator, I got a text from a great guy in Hollywood a minute ago. I mentor an 18-year-old former foster kid, high school graduate, working hard with a full-time job as a cabinet maker. Got laid off today due to virus. He didn't file a 2018 tax form since he was 16 then. So, with the current relief bill, what does he do for food and rent at this point?
So, in addition to the direct cash payments, which you're right, are based on 2018 tax returns, Hugh, we have increased unemployment significantly, a $600 increase across the board for every state's benefit. That will go on for at least 3 months in the bill that Senator McConnell introduced. I've advocated that we should extend it for more months if necessary to get through this crisis. But anyone who has been employed and who has been laid off should go to their state unemployment insurance system, preferably online or on phone, which every state has, and file a claim for benefits. That is not pegged to your historic tax returns. It is pegged to the job that you had before this crisis started.
Is that in the McConnell bill?
Yes, it's been in the McConnell bill from the very beginning. Hugh, a week ago, I was advocating both kinds of payments because I knew that our families would be desperate to get money into their hands as millions of people are losing their jobs because of this pandemic. Both tax rebates that are based on tax filings from 2018, the IRS tax filings we have, and increased unemployment payments. So to give you a sense, Hugh, the average unemployment payment in Arkansas is about $400 a month, plus or minus $40. $600 more per month means that people up to about $50,000 a year will have their income matched for the next 3 or 4 months, wherever we end up settling.
Is it $600 per month or per week, Senator?
Per week. I'm sorry, per week.
Yeah, I thought so. Yeah.
$400 per week is the average benefit in Arkansas right now. Other states vary, but $600 increase across the board in all states per week means that people into the $40,000 or $50,000 range will have their income matched for these next few weeks, these next vital few weeks when we know people can't work, when they can't earn an income. This is not a permanent program. This is not a permanent expansion of the government. These are emergency matters.
Senator,
unlike anything we faced.
Do the Democrats not have a heart? Do they not know what? As Susan Collins talked about her Lewiston diner. I know what's going on. Do they not know? Do they not care?
Hugh, as Rahm Emanuel, a former Democratic leader in Congress and Barack Obama's chief of staff, said, never let a crisis go to waste. And that's what they're doing.
Meanwhile, around the world, other countries are ravaged. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo joined me on my show to discuss how America is holding the line, especially vis-a-vis China. Can you confirm the report that the G7 disagrees with you over your belief we ought to call this the Wuhan virus?
So different countries take different approaches. I will say this. I was actually pleased yesterday. The EU countries that are part of the G7 made very clear, as did my Japanese counterpart, that the Chinese disinformation campaign that the Chinese are actively engaged in, even as we speak, trying to defer blame, trying to claim that they are the solution to this. And in fact, they weren't the nation at the very beginning of this, had the one country that had the opportunity and the data set that could have put this virus in a much better place than we are today and failed to do so. The G7 countries yesterday were unanimous in saying we understand that this is a risk, that this is a problem both to the EU and to the United States and the world, and they agreed to jointly work alongside us to push back against this disinformation campaign.
But on a name, they cannot agree?
Everybody's got a different theory. My theory is we should always be accurate with respect to how we identify something. This virus began in Wuhan. I've referred to it as the Wuhan virus. It is important that the world understands how this began because, you know, we need transparency to save lives. It's that simple. We need facts and data. China has a special responsibility to be transparent because the outbreak started in China, in Wuhan, and the Chinese government was the first to know about it.
Does General Secretary Xi owe the world an apology and an explanation?
I'll leave that to him. What I can tell you are the facts. You'll recall, Hugh, that at the very onset of this, when America first learned about this, we did our best to make sure that we had transparency and information. We offered to send our expert medical providers in. We offered to make sure that we could provide whatever support they needed. And instead of cracking down on the virus in a timely fashion, they cracked down on information flow. They kicked journalists out. They punished those who were speaking about this inside of their own country. When you have challenges, when you have crises like this one, the most important thing at the onset is to make sure that the world gets access to the data that they need to prevent this, to prevent the spread of this. And the Chinese government did not act in a way that's consistent with that global need, that global demand.
I wish to play for you, Dr. Fauci, on CNN last night, a quick clip, cut number 23.
Italy got hit very badly because they had a large number of importations from China by Chinese tourists.
Do you agree with that, Secretary Pompeo?
I do. That's factually accurate. I think if I heard the clip right, that was Italy he was referring to.
Yes.
That's also the case in Iran, that there were many flights between China and Iran, and we think that there are, in fact, many nations that had their outbreak begin with transit from China. And it's important to know, too, it was the case at the onset of this. There were countries that wanted to close their doors to Chinese travel, to Chinese, and the Chinese government pushed back against them, asking them to keep their airports open in an effort to protect China from the stigma that might be attached with having transportation closed down. President Trump made a very different decision. He made a decision early on that we were going to protect America by reducing transit from China into the United States. It was a really good decision that gave us some window, some opportunity to save lives here in the United States. I regret that other countries weren't as quick and as responsive to that risk.
I regret that at the time, Vice President Biden and others denounced that as xenophobic and racist.
It was sound policy based on good data and protected American lives.
Mr. Secretary, your friend and mine, Senator Cotton, as well as Admiral Stavridis, also your friend, early to the bell on this virus, as you were, as the president was. Now, Senator Cotton and Congressman Gallagher want dramatic action on dependence on Chinese manufactured pharmaceuticals, not only for us, but for the free world.
I would go further in the sense of I think those are absolutely critical things. We need to fundamentally review our supply chains and make sure that we know those supply chains and have control over them for moments just like this.
While countless companies are struggling to make ends meet, some businesses have turned their attention to helping America in this time of need. Salem host Mike Gallagher tells of one such story from Mike Lindell and his company, MyPillow.
You guys have stepped up in a big way, and I am very proud to have you make the announcement about what you're doing right now with regards to healthcare workers all over America. First of all, before the announcement, how are you doing?
I'm doing great. It's really gave me a lot of hope the last few days here when we finally got this to fruition here, all the work we've done over the past couple of weeks. But we are now making face masks for hospitals across the country. And it's funny you brought up Peter Navarro. He's been a big help to me. This administration is doing so much to bridge things between the private sector and government, and it's just been amazing. But we're in full production on masks as of today, face masks. And I even switched over, Mike. We have where my toppers are made in Massachusetts and Connecticut, and also some of my products being made in North Carolina. We switched them all over to face masks, so we are going to be producing. I want to be getting up there around 45,000 a day. I'm just, we're cranking them out.
Coming up, when Dr. Anthony Fauci was not by the president's side, many in the media assumed there must be a problem.
Reading into my not being there as a risk with the president is absolutely ridiculous. It really is. There's nothing like that going on at all.
The nation's top doctor. When the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
Hi, I'm Jim Daly with Focus on the Family. The coronavirus pandemic has made life chaotic and unpredictable for everyone. It's in times like these we search for something we can truly count on. We need a true north. In the current crisis, I believe true north is loving your neighbor as yourself. And we can do that by using our time and talent and resources to help assist someone who is vulnerable or in need. And let's remember, together we'll get through this.
Our program is coming in today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. They are preparing grounded leaders who are impacting public policy and serving in the public square. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. Until recently, few in America knew the name of Dr. Anthony Fauci, despite the fact he has been director of the National Institute of Allergy and Infectious Diseases since 1984. That's right, as far back as the Reagan administration. You heard him on my program last week. This week, he joined Salem's Chris DeGaulle on 990 The Answer out of Philadelphia.
Here's the first thing I'm going to ask you. Just 30,000-foot view, doctor. I think by now you understand, well, you've understood the game for a long time. Media seems very, very keen to try to figure out your every move and every gesture and what it means and what it doesn't mean. And is there a rift and what goes on behind closed doors with you and President Trump? And I've had more than a few people point out you weren't present at the briefing yesterday and the one before that. And now people are trying to read meaning into this. So do you care to address that?
Sure. There really is nothing to that. We have a team on the task force. I'm up there most of the time. Every once in a while, I have to get back to my job at the National Institutes of Health because we're the ones that are responsible for developing the drugs and the vaccines that are going to be important. So I spend every day, part of the day, at the White House, sometimes all day at the White House. Occasionally, there'll be a time where I need to leave and just go back and do my job, my day job, and then come back, reading into my not being there as a rift with the president is absolutely ridiculous. It really is. There's nothing like that going on at all.
Do you like working with this president? Do you like the man personally?
Yes, I do. I do. I mean, he's got his own style. He's a very decisive person. He's deliberate. He cares about doing the right thing. I mean, I've worked now over the last 36 years in my job with every president since Ronald Reagan. You know, every one of them are different. They have their own style. They have their own way. I do enjoy working with him.
So any suggestion that this president is summarily dismissing you because your science-based take on the news of the day or the events of this pandemic, he has no time for you because you're frustrating his agenda. That's put out there a lot. You would say to that?
No, that is completely untrue. I mean, I meet with him virtually every day, I think every day for the last weeks. He listens. I have never had a situation where I strongly suggested something to him that he rejected. And almost all the time when I say be careful about this, he listens and he is. I mean, I think this idea of a conflict between the two of us is just absolutely not based on any reality.
I'm going to do my best to not ask you any political questions because you're not a politician, you're a doctor. But I do want to ask you about the media coverage of this event and as these events have unfolded. And you stand there every day watching this press corps fire questions at you, the president, the vice president, all your colleagues. Is this media, this press corps, are they fair? Are they doing the country well right now, in your view?
You know, I don't think I can make a judgment on that. They're trying to do their job. I have a great deal of respect for the United States media, the press. I mean, even the global press. They're trying to do their job. To some people, they may seem that they're being harsh. To others, they may seem that they're being not too harsh. So I don't really pass judgment on the media. I just think that most of them, obviously, when you have such a large group, there are going to be some of them in there that don't behave very well. But on the whole, I think the media do a good job.
Our last pandemic, or I don't know if it was called a pandemic by definition, H1N1, outbreak for certain, many thousands died when it was all said and done. And the question's been asked of me to pass on to you. Did we not learn enough? Was this our failure of imagination? Why did we seem so flat-footed on this?
Because this is a completely new virus. I mean, the pandemic of H1N1, I mean, at the end of the day, its impact is nothing compared to what we're going through right now. I mean, the number of deaths of that pandemic in 2009 were even less in many respects than a regular seasonal flu. It was a pandemic. It was new. It spread rapidly. But its mortality was relatively low. I think people don't appreciate that. I mean, if you want to talk about pandemics with high mortalities, I mean, the one that just overshadows everything else is the 1918 catastrophe, which was literally 50 to 100 million people worldwide died at a time when the population of the country was only one-third of what it is right now. We had a bad one in 1957 and a bad one in 1968. What we're going through now is unpredictable. This is a highly transmissible virus that has a high degree of morbidity and mortality. If you look at seasonal flu, the thing that we go through every year, the mortality is about 0.1%. Right now, the mortality in China was about 2 to 3%. In Italy and other places, it's about 1 to 2%. And in other countries, it's maybe 1 or less. No matter how you look at it, it's clearly much, much more lethal than just a typical seasonal flu.
Dr. Fauci, the president has brought up hydroxychloroquine and chloroquine, the malaria drug.
Well, as I've said many times, the data that indicate that are really anecdotal and not proven. We can say, let's try it. It might work. There's nothing wrong with that. But make sure we try it under the appropriate condition.
One of America's most beautiful campuses, Pepperdine University, sits atop a hill in Malibu, California, overlooking the Pacific Ocean. Pete Peterson is the dean of the School of Public Policy at Pepperdine, where students are intimately involved in the effort to keep Californians informed during this crisis. California has two of America's largest and most crowded cities. A poisonous cocktail in the world of COVID-19. Peterson joined me on the Hugh Hewitt Show. There are all sorts of conflicting models from there, and the two are Imperial College and Oxford. The doom and gloom is Imperial. The best case is Oxford. What's your assessment of all the data about how I think it's an international Katrina event? What do you think, Pete Peterson?
No, I think that's a very fair case. I think what's been so difficult about it is everybody's waiting for the peak to hit. And certainly out here in California, right now we're ticking in around 2,600 cases, certainly not nearly as much as we're seeing in some of the other states like Washington and New York. But everyone around here is bracing for this tsunami, if you will, of cases, which at least from what most of the experts are saying, we should see in the next week to 2 weeks. And so I think at that point we'll have a much better assessment of what the larger scope and scale. It's such a different challenge than what we faced in Woolsey. You know, with the fire or some of these other natural disasters, it happens and then you can get a damage assessment of what you're looking at and what the next few months will look like. And this is kind of a rolling set of changes that you're always evaluating. I'm on daily morning emergency operation calls with the university is where all the deans are checking in and always reevaluating new data that's coming in.
I'm curious if your public policy students committed to careers as they are in the public sector have been shaken by this, because the responsibility is enormous, right?
It really is, Hugh, and thankfully we started a new initiative about a year ago, specifically in crisis management and disaster response. The group has actually been working with the city and county of Los Angeles to put up a GIS-based online map to track where the cases are and where emergency services are. And so in many ways, our students are learning really in real time, not only the career opportunities that have been made available through this, but really the importance of public service in a time of crisis.
Coming up.
Finally, the Chinese authorities locked down Wuhan province. But here's the kicker. After 5 million people were allowed to leave Wuhan city without screening.
A China disaster timeline. The Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt continues in a moment. Hey, thanks for listening to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Our podcast is sponsored by Alliance Defending Freedom. ADF provides help at no cost to those whose liberty is being violated, but they can't do it without your help. Call 800-691-8969. That's 800-691-8969. Or visit townhallreview.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Brought to you in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. I'm Hugh Hewitt. There's little question China bears a tremendous responsibility for what is happening in the rest of the world. The coronavirus began in Wuhan and festered there before being unleashed on the rest of the world. Could China have stopped it? Maybe. But at very least, they could have helped the world contain it with a little more honesty. Salem host Sebastian Gorka reads through the timeline of events in China.
Here's something I've been wanting to share with you since I got it in my paws yesterday. It's from my friends in the administration, and it is fascinating. This is the real deal. So bear with me. This is the outline of what happened in China, the facts with regards to the Wuhan virus outbreak. You may want to write these down because these are the facts that you need to know. First things first, November 17th last year, the first case of someone in China suffering from COVID-19, the disease caused by the novel coronavirus, is traced, according to government data seen by the South China Morning Post. December 10th, Wei Jixian, a seafood merchant in this Wuhan Hunan market, first started to feel sick. She was later discharged from hospital in January, having survived the coronavirus. That's from the Wall Street Journal. December 27th, Zhang Jingyang, a doctor from Hubei Provincial Hospital of Integrated Chinese and Western Medicine, tells China's health authorities that a novel disease has affected some 180 patients and was caused by the new coronavirus. December 26th to the 30th,
Evidence of a new virus emerges from the Wuhan patient data sent to multiple Chinese genomics companies. So these are companies that match the genome, and this is the first evidence that has been sent to those companies inside China. One day later, December 31st, Chinese officials finally alert the World Health Organization China Country Office of several cases of pneumonia of unknown cause detected in Wuhan. That's all they did. January 9th, the World Health Organization releases a statement on a cluster of pneumonia cases in Wuhan province. Same day, Chinese authorities identify a novel coronavirus as the likely cause of the outbreak in Wuhan 2 days after the Wall Street Journal reports on Chinese scientists discovering the novel strain. January 11th. Having provided the genomic sequence of the virus to national authorities on January 5th and seeing no action from them, Professor Zhang Yongzhen of the Shanghai Public Health Clinical Center publishes the data publicly on virological.org and GenBank, allowing teams around the world to begin on testing methods. The next day, the National Health Commission shares virus genomic information with the World Health Organization for the first time. From November the 17th, it took until January 12th. 2 days later, the WHO reports for the first time that they may, the first time! It takes until January for the World Health Organization to report there may have been limited human-to-human transmission of the new virus. And this is the most stunning. Are you ready for this? Just 4 days later, Wuhan province hosts a public potluck banquet for 40,000 families because they want to break a world's record. 40,000 families in one place together. 2 days later, Dr. Zhong Nanshang, a leading authority on respiratory health, well known for his role in fighting the original SARS virus, confirms in a TV interview that the disease is spreading from person to person. He later said that if the government had taken action earlier, the Chinese government, in December or even early January, quote, the number of sick would have been greatly reduced, close quote. January 23rd, finally, the Chinese authorities locked down Wuhan province. But here's the kicker. After 5 million people were allowed to leave Wuhan city without screening in the middle of the outbreak, 5 million people. Final fact. February the 7th of this year, Dr. Li Wenliang dies of the novel coronavirus contracted from a patient 5 weeks after his police detention for trying to alert fellow doctors to the outbreak.
Coming up.
Most people are not afraid they're going to get sick. Most people are not afraid they're going to die. They're afraid of the uncertainty.
Arthur Brooks, when the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt returns in a moment.
Our program is coming today in partnership with the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy. It's America's most unique graduate leadership programs offered on Pepperdine's breathtaking campus in Malibu, California. Learn more at publicpolicy.pepperdine.edu.
Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt, brought to you in partnership with ADEA, Alliance Defending Freedom. There is a lot of fear in times like this. Job loss, and many have already experienced that. Businesses failing, of course, health concerns. People in the hospital, people afraid they will be in the hospital. People fear losing their homes, their livelihoods, their independence, most important of all, their loved ones. In light of all this, I turn to Arthur Brooks, former president of the American Enterprise Institute, and currently a member of the Harvard faculty. Arthur has written extensively on love and happiness. He's a good friend and a treasure, especially in times like these.
You are really an expert on happiness, which also makes you an expert on fear. And I'd like, am I right about that?
Well, fear is not the opposite of happiness. Fear is the opposite of love. And love is the nuclear fuel of happiness. So you're pretty close. People are very, very fearful right now. And therein lies some of the solutions to our problems.
That's what I want. You have the floor. I knew this would be a gold mine of wisdom. Tell us what to do about fear.
Well, so what's going on right now is that most people are not afraid they're going to get sick. Most people are not afraid they're going to die. They're afraid of the uncertainty. You know, they know that their stock portfolio is going to come back. They're not so stupid that they're selling their stocks. They know they're not going to retire penniless. The problem is they don't know what's going to happen in the next month, the next 2 months, the next 6 months. And that uncertainty naturally brings fear. If you're suffering from fear, you have to recognize it. And the only solution to that is to surround yourself with love. Love conquers, perfect love drives out fear. That's the first letter of St. John's.
How do you do that?
Well, that's my column in the Washington Post this weekend, as a matter of fact. And there are a bunch of different ways to do it. And the key thing to keep in mind is that one of the reasons that people suffer when they're in their homes alone or when they're quarantining, or as we now say, awkwardly social distancing, which is a term I hope will kill forever after this is over. The problem with that is that we're missing a neurotransmitter, a hormone in the brain called oxytocin. This is a neurotransmitter that's intensely pleasurable that comes about from touch and from eye contact. And what that does is it basically signals to the brain that there is love in your life, and that will drive out your fear of uncertainty, fear of the unknown. But you have to stimulate it manually when you're not getting it naturally. So this is the key thing that we have to keep in mind for Americans right now. They're social distancing. In a few days, we'll probably all be sheltering in place, as far as we all know. And if that's the case, we have to spend more time actually making actual eye contact when we talk. We need to stop using social media and start using Skype and FaceTime to talk to people so we can actually see them in their eyes. And every person in your house needs therapeutically 20 seconds of hugging every 2 hours. This is a prescription from your social scientist friend, Dr. Arthur Brooks.
Now, I you're serious. I want people to understand. This is a genuine, actual, physiological prescription.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Oxytocin is no joke. Oxytocin is really one of the reasons that people feel that life is worth living. It's the explosion of pleasure that you get when you see an old friend, when you see your child, when you see your child born for the first time, when you see the person with whom you're in love. And it comes from eye contact and touch, and we don't get enough of it when we change our behaviors and become isolated. Therefore, we have to therapeutically look for occasions to get this love. This will make us have a much better time. We'll be much more comfortable. And most importantly, this is what will eradicate the kind of visceral fear of uncertainty that we're feeling right now.
Now, this really makes me worried about seniors who are widows or widowers. You know, I'm always with the Fetching Mrs. Hewitt, whether virtually or together. She's on one coast right now. I'm here, but we talk like 20 times a day. Often on Facebook, I FaceTime my grandkids. Tony Fauci told me I can't go see them, but I talk to them. So I get that. Mm-hmm. But what about a senior who can't receive visitors and isn't really equipped to use social media?
So that's a much bigger problem. And one side point on that, by the way, I was talking to, you know Jim Toohey, who ran the faith-based offices for W. He's now running a great nonprofit in D.C. called Aging with Dignity. And he made this point to me yesterday. He said, you know, all the things that people are feeling right now about isolation and loneliness, that's what a lot of seniors feel all the time. We're going to suffer through it for a month. They suffer through it through years. What can we do to alleviate that for them? And most importantly, what can we do about it later for our brothers and sisters who are older and tend to be more isolated? To begin with, the senior centers where people live, relatively isolated, if they're living together, they need not to be isolated from one another. That's the important thing. If they're hunkering down, they should hunker down together. That's important. The second thing is that senior centers and families who have relatively isolated elderly family members need to equip them more with technology right now. It's very important. I mean, I realize that they're relatively uncomfortable with it, but if you can, find a way such that you can see each other face-to-face, even if it's virtually. This will be incredibly important for the quality of life of senior citizens, and by the way, of all the people who are listening to us as well.
Now, Arthur Brooks, I have been preaching a little bit, and I actually have stayed off of Twitter because I found after one day, it's a cesspool of cruelty. It's not good for people who are alone to go there.
Yeah, no, it's, you know, the truth is, it's never good. Even if we don't have a pandemic, even if we're not sheltering in place, stay off social media. The data are in. They're it's just incontrovertibly true that if you're on Twitter or any social media for more than half an hour a day, the longer you're on it, the lonelier you'll get. It's empty calories. It's like eating French fries and hamburgers when you're hungry. You don't get enough nutrients, so you stay hungry even as you get fatter. Lonely people, they binge on social media and wind up lonelier. The reason that people are so terrible to each other on social media is because they're lonely. This is poison. We need to stay away from it.
Now, I also want to talk generally about the media because people listen to you, Arthur. I think our jobs are to ensure, inform, and encourage. What do you think media's job is?
Media's job right now, of course, is to do the things that we're talking about, but also to give people solutions and to encourage them in a way that does not divide them from one from the other. Remember, if this were a war, if this were World War II, and this is a kind of a war, we would be banding together. The greatest time in American unity in my lifetime was right after 9/11, where people were really banding together, where Democrats and Republicans just realized how stupidly little these differences were. The main reason that we're not achieving that as well as we should right now, I believe, is because there's a profit motive. It's sort of the outrage industrial complex in this country, where people are getting famous and rich and getting clicks and followers on the basis of dividing each other. It's a very profitable business. It's absolutely time in media and politics, and on social media in particular, for people to abandon that and for all the rest of us to rebel, to say, look, you know, no dividers, I'm sorry. You know, you notice that it's not a coincidence that suddenly the country is turning away from politicians who are being dividers, who are naturally dividers, who are telling us that we need to hate our neighbors. We don't want that right now. And media can play a big role and actually be the vanguard of changing American culture, of bending the curve of hatred, as you so appropriately pointed out, toward greater unity as we come out of this crisis.
Coming up, forget toilet paper. There's a run on weapons.
I saw many reports of stores literally being sold out of everything they had in inventory, every single item they had in inventory gone.
Stay tuned for the final segment of Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt in a moment.
If you enjoy the Town Hall Review and you are a person of faith, let me introduce you to another podcast I think you'll like. It's the Christian Outlook, and in it you'll hear the leading voices in the Christian world engaging the issue of the day.
This week, cases of coronavirus in New York City skyrocket.
New York is really the epicenter of the whole thing right now.
Congress makes progress on a massive aid package, but how and when do we get our economy moving again? Newt Gingrich.
I think we should be mass-producing tests as fast as we can, and start moving towards testing everybody.
We'll get gospel perspective amidst all the angst.
You can put that fear and insecurity into Christ and say, be my Lord, be my Savior, protect me.
And our opportunity and our obligation to our neighbor in trying times, Rosaria Butterfield.
They need to know who Jesus is.
We've got all this and more. To subscribe, go to ChristianOutlook.com. That's ChristianOutlook.com. Welcome back to the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Several mayors of large cities have announced that they are relaxing their policies on arrest. Some have even begun releasing prisoners deemed non-threatening. Combine that with a virus that has folks feeling uncertain about their future, and we have a situation where people feel that police may not be able to protect them. Sebastian Gorka spoke with John Patton of the Gun Collective.
Things are crazy right now, John. I just popped into my local gun store on Saturday. And I tell you, I have never seen anything like it. The parking lot, the lot was completely, completely chocker. You could barely move inside the building. Is this, you're plugged into everybody. Is this a nationwide phenomenon?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. Everybody that was unprepared, and even those that were prepared but still wanted more, went out and tried to buy stuff. I mean, it's to the point now where distributors, you know, that the next level up from your dealers and even some manufacturers are struggling to keep up or are completely sold out.
And
there are stores nationwide. I saw many reports of stores literally being sold out of everything they had in inventory. Every single item they had in inventory gone. That is incredible.
My buddy at the local gun store said they had 20,000 rounds of 9mm arrive on Friday. It didn't last till the end of closing. It was gone. It was sold like that. And he also said the majority of people coming in, John, have no idea about guns. Zero. That's not necessarily a good thing, right?
Well, I mean, I look at it as an opportunity to educate.
Yes.
You know, this is a chance for gun shop owners to either convert or better educate those that
yes.
are in the middle or maybe on the other side. You know, why not take this as a chance to say, look, here's all these things that you didn't quite understand or you voted for without thinking it through. And here's why these draconian, you know, nonsensical laws are not in our favor. And that's a great opportunity to do that for gun shop owners, gun shop employees, everybody, really. And I think it's a good chance to bring more people on side.
What are you hearing about what the Democrats are trying to do, the devilish, disingenuous things they're trying to do at this time of national emergency?
It's really, really snake in the grass type stuff. You know, they're out there talking about this coronavirus is a pandemic and it's crazy. And whether or not you're fully bought into that mindset, what they're trying to do in Congress is sneak through bills to further limit our rights. And I think it's really, really, it shows their true colors even more than, you know, prior attempts at this, because they know people are not watching. They know people are not being vigilant right now because they're focused on other things. And, you know, this is their opportunity to try and sneak something through to take more control and further limit people's rights. And it's honestly just despicable.
Thanks for joining us for the Town Hall Review with Hugh Hewitt. Catch up on earlier episodes on our website, townhallreview.com. Sign up for a daily dose of the best in talk radio. Special thanks to executive producer Russell Shubin, producer Charlie Richard, David Posey and Michael Cook, Adam Ramsey and Dwayne Patterson. And let me say thanks once again to our sponsors, the Pepperdine Graduate School of Public Policy and ADF, Alliance Defending Freedom. I'm Hugh Hewitt. Thank you for joining us.